You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Only who is left. Survivorship bias and the martial arts. Today I'm going to discuss one of the many cognitive biases that we as humans all have, whether we like it or not. Cognitive biases are quirks of human thinking, leftovers from the simpler brains of our ancestors that steer us away from rationality and critical thinking in the direction of magical thinking, emotionality, and storytelling. These biases figuratively hang around our brains like anchors, slowing down our progress as a species. They are inextricably part of us. We can't make them go away without making our brains go away. Instead, we must carefully watch for them to rear their ugly heads and then manage the situation as best we can when they do. And that's what skepticism and critical thinking skills are all about. Not so much to win arguments with other people, which is mostly another primitive human urge, but to catch yourself in the act of allowing the chimp to get his hands on the controls. As someone who is powerfully interested in skepticism and critical thinking, I like to think that my education about logical fallacies and cognitive biases, of the weakness of human perception and memory, can inoculate me from the weaknesses of my own brain. But the truth is that I catch myself employing cognitive biases and logical fallacies all the time, and it embarrasses me, and it really pisses me off. But I, and all the rest of us, need to remember that we have very fallible brains that are prone to lead us down all sorts of blind alleys. The best solution is continuing education and constant vigilance. Today's cognitive bias is the survivorship bias. The survivorship bias happens when there's some sort of selective process or pressure dictating the course of an event. That process could be a disaster in which most people die, but some survive. It could be a sports tournament competition that results in one athlete earning the title of champion. It could be who earns a coveted job out of a large cohort of applicants. It could be a desperate military mission, which kills all but a few of the valiant soldiers, sailors, marines, or airmen who go in. Whatever the case, the selective pressure or process assures that not all who started finish. Why is this significant? Because we learn less statistically from the survivors than we do from those who do not survive. But our love for a good story draws us to the survivor. One of the common themes that I try to strike in this podcast series is that our quirky human brain is much more easily compelled by a story than by statistics. Tell a human being a story about thousands of people dying in a disaster, and it's statistically more likely that he or she will mutter an appropriate phrase like, "Oh, that's terrible," and then quickly move on to another topic without further dwelling on the victims. But tell them the story of a lone survivor of such an event, and it's more likely that their attention will be riveted. We humans love stories and hate statistics, and thus are drawn to the survivors like moths to a flame. We lionize those who survive and relegate those who didn't to irrelevancy. Again, if true, why is this significant? It's significant because our desire for a compelling story leads us to conclude that survivors share some special quality, when often in reality the fact that they survived is because of coincidence and happenstance. If we wish to learn how to mitigate or even to avoid future disasters, or to understand what significance to draw from who survives and who does not, we need to learn to examine not only the survivors of selective processes, but those who did not survive as well. In episode 75 of this podcast, entitled There Ain't No Such Thing as a Free Sample, I discussed the importance of getting a representative sample when conducting studies and experiments, and that one of the most important aspects of this was the size of the sample. By definition, the survivors of any arduous process will constitute a very small sample size. Let's look at some examples of survivorship bias. There's a famous story about the Greek philosopher Diogenes. He was fond of horrifying his fellow citizens by poking fun at the gods. One of these citizens took him to task for this attitude and said that the gods were responsible for saving his brother, who was the only survivor of a horrible shipwreck. Diogenes' reply was to say, "Who but the gods drowned all of those other poor people who didn't survive?" This may be one of the earliest recorded references to survivorship bias. In World War II, American and British bomber crews suffered extremely high casualty rates during missions against Nazi targets in Europe. Researchers from the Center for Naval Analysis conducted studies of the returning bombers, carefully noting the location of bullet and shrapnel holes. These experts recommended that the planes be redesigned with reinforcement in the areas where they found the most holes. But a statistician named Abraham Wilde understood survivorship bias. He rightly pointed out to the analysts that they had not studied any of the aircraft which had not returned from their missions. He further pointed out that it was statistically far more likely that the areas on the safely returned Allied bombers that indicated needed reinforcement were those areas that had suffered no bullet or shrapnel holes on many of the surviving aircraft, and that if they had been hit in those places, they would have been statistically likely to have joined the unfortunate group of aircraft that had been shot down. Before you chime in with clever advice that both sets of areas should be reinforced, remember that aircraft need to be light enough to take off, maneuver, and to be fuel efficient. For a very different example of survivorship bias, let's look at classical music. It's not uncommon to hear someone say something like, "They sure don't write music like that anymore." But the truth is that back in the day when our favorite classical music was written, most other composers didn't write very well either. But their music did not survive to this day. What we think of as classical music is not representative of the music of that era. Instead, it is the very best of the best music of that era. The crappy music from that time period is, thankfully, not around to assail our ears. This is a good example of both survivorship bias and the Golden Age fallacy being applied at the same time. By the way, I already covered the Golden Age fallacy way back in episode 27 of this podcast, entitled, appropriately enough, The Golden Age Fallacy. A similar example occurs with manufactured goods. We've all heard someone refer to an old model car, or washing machine, or vacuum cleaner, with the phrase, "Yeah, they don't make them like that anymore." Again, this is both an example of survivorship bias and the Golden Age fallacy. There was plenty of crappy manufacturing back in the good old days. By definition, if something was badly manufactured, it did not survive long enough for your Uncle Willard to be induced to utter those words. "Yeah, they sure don't make them like that anymore." Let's look at an example of survivorship bias from scientific research. This is the file drawer effect. That's the phenomenon that people who conduct scientific studies tend to not publish the results when they are negative. For example, if a new drug is being tested, and the test indicates no significant therapeutic effect, the research is often simply dropped because there's no money to be made, and results tend to not be published. This is not because the scientists are trying to hide information. It's simply that writing a paper is a lot of work and costs a lot of money. And under our current system, there's little incentive to make that effort simply to announce that you found nothing. Another force influencing papers with negative findings to not be published is that most of the influential scientific journals want to publish papers that people will read. people tend to be bored when reading papers about a study that came to a negative conclusion. But all this means that without this information, others may have the same idea and attempt the same study, not knowing it had already been tried and failed once, and perhaps waste their time and money. So only the studies that survive the process by having positive results don't end up in the file drawer. This phenomenon dramatically skews our perception of reality, leaving out any information that could have been drawn from articles written about studies with negative results. So, how does survivorship bias rear its ugly head in the martial arts? First, let's look at martial sport competition. Take, for example, grappling tournaments, most of which tend to be single elimination events. What does it mean when one of the athletes ends up winning the championship match? Does it mean that he or she is the best? What meaning should we draw or not draw from the word champion? I regularly see weight divisions in grappling tournaments with only 3, 4, or 5 individuals in the pool of athletes for competition for that weight. Assuming that there is one of them who is actually the best, which is in reality quite an involved topic for another discussion, it's possible that he could be injured during his first match, or, despite being the best, commit a perfectly human mental error and lose to someone he would usually defeat. It's even quite possible for this to happen to the 2 best athletes in the pool. I've seen that happen myself. In that case, the first place medal will go to a lesser athlete, partly because he competed well, and partly because his betters did not survive to meet him. This is why good coaches are fond of telling you that you can't control everything that happens in the competition. Your best bet is to be well prepared and focused in order to put yourself in the best position to have a chance to win. And try not to read too much into it when you do win. Another lesson that martial artists can take from the survivorship bias is this. Ponder the question, what does it take to become a very high-level martial artist? While I think it's true that a certain amount of talent is necessary, it's more important to remember the most obvious factor. You can't become a very high-level martial artist, no matter what your level of talent, if you quit training before you reach that exalted status. Our quirky human brains, through the survivorship bias, draw us to examine and even become obsessed by the characteristics of the martial artist who survives many years of training. That means we don't tend to look at those martial artists who did not survive the process. What made them quit? Is it only the stubbornness of the survivor? Or is there something about the way many schools conduct martial arts training that drives students away? In any case, this phenomenon reinforces the prophetic words of the founder of judo, Jigoro Kano, who, when asked what the secret was to the mastery of judo, replied, "Never miss practice." Another lesson that the survivorship bias brings us regarding the martial arts has to do with academies that survive for a long time. The academy that I own and operate, the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy, is the oldest operating academy in its market area. Does that necessarily say something about the quality of my instruction? Well, survivorship bias, and of course my own ego, might induce me to say yes. I'm too close to the question of the quality of my instruction to be objective about it. But I suspect that a huge hidden factor in the longevity of my academy is that I was willing to tolerate a much greater degree of poverty through the years than were many of my competitors. That's a factor that would never occur to most people because of survivorship bias. The tendency is to examine my academy for data about longevity, but not the academies that did not survive. So just as your kickboxing coach wisely advises you to keep your guard up, you should also keep your guard up cognitively for these nasty biases that we all have. See if you can catch yourself committing the mistake of survivorship bias. And remember the words of one of my favorite humans, Bertrand Russell, who said, "War does not determine who is right. It determines only who is left." Anyway, that's what I think. but I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, and check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.